What's up, y'all? Kelly Clarkson with Wayfair. My favorite thing about the holidays? Decking out my whole house. It's not a competition, but if it was, well, I'd win the season with Wayfair. Outdoor inflatable Santa? Got it on Wayfair. Trees, lights, and ornaments? Wayfair. Hosting must-haves like dining sets, beds, sheets, and towels? Wayfair. For everything in your style delivered with fast and free shipping, visit Wayfair.com or the Wayfair app to win the season. But again, it's not a competition.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Welcome to Sexology, a podcast that untangles the science of sex and pleasure. And now, with this week's episode, your host, clinical psychologist, Dr. Nazanin Moali.
Welcome back to another episode of the Sexology podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nazanin Moali. Today, we're having a very real, very honest conversation about intimacy, care, trauma, chronic illness, and the kind of connection most of us never thought to imagine. My guest is Margot Feldman, a writer, public educator, artist, and the brilliant creator of the @softcoretrauma Instagram account. They hold an MFA from CalArt, a PhD from University of Toronto, and are the author and the beautiful new memoir, Touch Me, I'm Sick. Margot has an incredible gift for naming the things so many of us feel but don't know how to talk about, the way we've been sold limited ideas of love and caregiving that often fall apart in long-term relationships, especially when trauma or chronic illness is involved. Today, we're exploring what happens when we stop trying to fix each other and smart witnessing instead. We talk about the ways of old wounds get louder in relationships, what hysterical intimacies really mean, and how pleasure, yes, even in moments of grief and illness, can become a form of healing. If you've ever wondered how to reconnect with sensuality when your body feels like it's let you down, or how queer mode of care can open new pathways to closeness, this episode will give you language, insight, and permission to rethink what intimacy can truly look like. But before we dive in, I want to thank our sponsor, Filthy MILFs. If you haven't listened yet, you are missing out on one of the funniest, boldest, and most surprisingly heartfelt conversations happening in the world of sexual wellness. Hosted by the hilarious duo Ellen Ansui and Sophie Levine, Filthy MILFs bring a joyfully unfiltered energy to everything from sex and aging to confidence, relationship, and pleasure. Their guest lineup is incredible too. You'll hear from sexologists, hormone therapy specialists, and sexual health experts, along with deeply personal conversations with filmmakers, authors, sex workers, swingers, and more. Listen to Filthy MILFs on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite shows. And for even more filthy goodness, check them out for free on Subtrack at Filthy MILFs. Hello and welcome back to another episode of the Sexology Podcast. I am so excited to welcome Margot Feldman. Margot, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I am excited about this conversation. I was very curious about the book when you guys reached out. It is a very interesting and much needed book. Tell us a little bit about how did you decide writing it? And for our audience, it's called Touch Me, I'm Sick.
Yeah, so this book actually began as my PhD dissertation. I did a PhD in English literature with a focus on queer literature, queer theory, theories of sexuality. And so, yeah, it began and, you know, its first iteration was as the dissertation, but it had even shifted in the process of writing it. I was initially drawn to thinking about trauma and intimacy and the legacy of hysteria. And then in 2016, I got sick and became chronically ill. And as I was waiting for the next doctor's appointment, you know, to try to figure out what was going on, you know, I kind of did what a graduate student would do. And I was like, well, I'm just going to try to find any book that I can, you know, on chronic illness and try to figure out what's going on with me. And it was then that I started to read these memoirs about chronic illness and memoirs that were talking about the connections between chronic illness and trauma. And at that point, I was like, oh, what I'm really writing about is actually sickness, being sick in the world. And so at that point, the project started to shift and became much more focused on bringing in conversations around disability, around chronic illness, and that became the dissertation. And then after I was done the PhD, I was like, all right, I want this to be a book that's in the world, but I don't want it to be just like an academic book. I want it to be something that anyone would want to pick up and read. And so at that point, I started to revise it and bring more of the personal into the story, because a lot of traditional academia is very much like you leave the personal out. It's this very objective analysis. And for me, I was like, well, everything about this project is personal to me. And so at that point, I went through a summer of making very significant revisions, and it became the book that is now out in the world.
It is very unique in a way that it talks about love and being loved. And I was like looking at this concept of what you talk about, the form of intimacy and care. We've been sold or woefully inadequate. I was so intrigued by that. Can you tell us a little bit about what does that mean? And how does it show up, how this concept in long-term partnerships?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I look back on my sweet baby Roland is maybe going to make some guest appearances in the podcast. He has many feelings and thoughts for us as well. Yeah, when I started to do this work of kind of interrogating, you know, what are the forms of intimacy that I really want and believe in? And what are the forms that, you know, mainstream media has sold me and continues to sell into like this moment that we're still all living in? And what I really noticed was that we understand intimacy and care kind of in these poles of either like independence or codependence. So either it's like, I don't need anyone, I can do this on my own, you know, this kind of radical independence where needing others is seen as a sign of weakness. Or on the other hand, this codependence where we become so enmeshed with another person that even our own needs, our own desires begin to get erased or become so caught up in what the person we love desires. And so what we really need, though, is, you know, this secret third thing called interdependence, where, you know, we are human beings that we deeply need one another from like a biological like perspective. We need one another for survival. And, you know, we also need to have our own individuality. And I think in a lot of like long-term relationships, and I speak from like, you know, for myself here so much, I became so worried about losing the bond with another person that I would sacrifice my own needs, my own desires in order to make the other person happy, you know? And you know, it's so common to hear people say like, well, I'm not happy unless you're happy. And which is like a kind of, it's a beautiful sentiment, but actually what we're doing is we are making ourselves responsible for another person's feelings and mood. And so I think that what that ends up, yeah, resulting in are these relationships where we no longer really know who we are and what it is we want, or we have to be so radically independent in that bond that we're actually closed off to connection, to support and care from another person. And, you know, so I think that, you know, tied up in this too is this like narrative that our romantic sexual partner is going to meet all of our needs. They are going to have everything that we could want. And that's like a lot of pressure. to place on one person, you know, because we're all going to have good days and bad days. We're all going to have other forces in our lives where sometimes we can't show up for the other person. And if we actually lived in a culture that promoted and celebrated interdependence, community, you know, friendship, then we wouldn't have to put all of that into our like long-term partnership. We could actually have versions of love and intimacy and care that are just so much more expansive.
You brought up so many great points. One, the idea of it's either you are living this independent life and pushing away your partner, right? That this feeling of like, I have my own life, you have your own life, or this like we are like all together, well, like one entity, which mm-hmm. also can be a thing for people, which it certainly is, but also people feel they lose themselves, and it's certainly not healthy for many people. Tell us more about the concept of interdependence. What does that look like?
Yeah, interdependence looks a lot like, you know, so if we think about that like phrase of like, I'm not happy unless you're happy, you know, that's very much like a kind of phrase of like codependence, you know, in a world of interdependence, it would be like, I'm sad that you're not happy, but I can still be happy in myself, you know, and I can love you and I can support you. But how I feel isn't actually dependent on how you're feeling. And so that's like one kind of way of thinking about interdependence. You know, interdependence can also look like, you know, celebrating the things that our partner loves to do separate from us. You know, like one of my partners loves to go camping, and I am more of a glamping kind of person, you know. So, you know, I want to like celebrate them in going with like their friends or other people in their lives that they have bonds with to go camping and not feel a way about that. I want to celebrate that. I want to uplift that in the same way that they would celebrate and uplift me in things that I want to do that they might not be interested in. Interdependence also looks like, you know, recognizing that it's not a weakness to need other people, that we actually all need one another. And, you know, it's about challenging this like myth of the individual who can just pick themselves up by the bootstraps, and, you know, that you're stronger if you can just do it yourself and take care of yourself, and be like, oh, well, like, actually, it's really nice to receive care. What a like a beautiful gift, you know, like I'm not feeling well. And, you know, I will have people in my life will be like, can I drop off food for you? You know, that is like an act of interdependence. So those are, yeah, some examples.
One of the things you talked about in the book, it is culture, wellness culture, which I feel like it, 5 minutes on Instagram, the healthiest individual feel they're failing life. As far as well, that psychological, physiological, all sorts of things that you must do in order to be well or even doing better or extending your life and biohacking. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think there are, it can have value, but there's like this pressure around it. So one of the things you talked about is how when we have it or we do have chronic illness or trauma, there are some types of pleasure and connection that there are available, and there are the ones that are not. There are some that are not available. Can you tell us about what's available?
Yeah. I think that, you know, as you've sort of pointed to, the kind of like, you know, stereotypical representation of like wellness culture is like the person who's got it all together. You know, they are waking up and they're going to the gym at 5 a.m. and, you know, they're drinking their smoothie and they're starting their day and everything is like healthy and like, I mean, man, if that's your life, like, I love that for you, if that's like feeling good for you. But what it doesn't allow for is a lot of space for like just like the messiness and vulnerability of being a human, even outside of having chronic illness or trauma. And so, you know, I think a lot about, you know, how, I guess one example of this is, you know, that I've been thinking about a lot and writing about is, as I've been doing a lot of work to heal sexual trauma in my current partnership, I've been crying a lot, like during and after sex. And in a particular kind of like wellness culture kind of narrative, that would be like horrifying, you know, to do. Like you need to like hold it together. And I definitely felt this like intense shame around that. But actually, you know, what my body was doing was just like processing like how incredible it feels to have like a healthy, safe, like sexual bond. And I'm releasing and like I'm healing through being in this connection. And I don't think that I could have allowed myself to have that response if I didn't accept myself as someone with trauma and chronic illness. So there's just like more space for me to be messy, more space for me to be vulnerable. I also think a lot too about how much ambivalence there is for us when it comes to pleasure as humans who live with trauma. Like we want pleasure, but pleasure actually feels terrifying because trauma is kind of the opposite of that. You know, it feels kind of awful, you know, to be living in a state of trauma, but it's what's familiar to us. And so experiences of pleasure can actually be like very deeply overwhelming for our nervous system. And so in the kind of like world that I live in with like the people in my life and what I want for all of us is to actually just be able to like own that it's like, I desire this, but I also feel scared, you know, or I'm feeling repulsion in my body. And we don't actually need to like pathologize that or see that as like a negative. We just actually see that as like a very real part actually of being human. We feel ambivalent about things all the time, including those that we love. It's like, you know, when like our partners like annoy us, like they really annoy us, right? You know, so those are, yeah, some of the ways that I think about like the forms of pleasure connection that aren't possible in wellness culture because there's so much like performativity in wellness culture of having it all together.
One thing that I'm always very excited about is when sexual trauma survivors, they kind of like work through the struggles and they develop a healthy and whatever healthy they describe as relationship with pleasure. And it can be very tricky for many of my clients. Like, as you probably have heard also, people, there's a part of it that they disconnect from your body, right? Like just, there's a part of you that you don't want to acknowledge something that happened and you're just like having all of these disconnected sex. And for some people, it's a form of avoidance. So how do we know that we have capacity to re-experience pleasure and have space to feel all the feeling you were talking about, like repulsion, sadness, whatever that comes up? Because early in recovery, I can imagine that's not something that's tolerable for individuals.
Yeah, I think so. One of the chapters of my book is called Ambivalent Desires, Ugly Sex. And I kind of, what I needed with the term ugly sex was sex that, like a term that describes exactly that experience of like being a human with sexual trauma who still wants to have sex, you know, but those experiences can be really triggering. And in order to access sexual pleasure, we often have to dissociate to some degree. That's like that feeling of disconnection, of like not being in our bodies. But it doesn't mean that, you know, actually the sex was necessarily bad or, you know, that there is anything wrong with it. But that within like feminist discourse of what like, you know, feminist sex is, it's like the unequivocally positive, yes, I want this, I'm present, like, you know, kind of sex. And we've been taught to see anything else that isn't that as somewhere in this like gray area to like non-gray area of like non-consensual sex. And so I think for me, I needed years and years and years of these kind of like ugly sexual experiences in order to actually get to a place where I could have the sex that was connected, where I could be present. And it, yeah, now that sex for me looks like crying a lot, you know, during and after it, because I'm actually connected to my body in a way that I haven't been for the majority of my life. So I think the first step is really noticing when we might be judging ourselves, you know, for, yeah, it's like, you know, you feel ashamed that you dissociated during sex. Well, no, what if we actually saw dissociation as it is, as actually a brilliant survival mechanism? You know, dissociation exists on the spectrum, you know, from everything from like meditation to daydreaming, like those are forms of dissociation, to, you know, the much more extreme examples where we're like just very detached from reality. And, you know, in our kind of model of wellness, of like, you know, psychic wellness, again, we're taught to really pathologize dissociation. So I would just say first, like, let's challenge that in ourselves. And let's find the beauty in how we are allowing ourselves to connect in a way that feels safe and really move at the speed of our nervous system. And that nervous system might need years and years and years of sex that looks like this before we can actually be more present.
And I appreciate highlighting of that, right? Because I think pleasure on its own can be healing. And it's not a switch that like you have trauma and then like you did 1, 2, 3. And then after that, those steps, everything will be perfect. So it's important to create space for all the different emotions that comes with this journey of being an erotic person. When you talked about your journey and your recovery, you said there were years of what you call oddly sex and then shifted toward this more embodied. And there are layers of emotion that shows up. Was it through kind of what we call in therapy exposure? Was it through the connection with a specific person? What created that shift for you?
I think it was like many different things. I think one part of it was getting into somatic therapy and yeah, just like learning, like I am so disconnected from my body in a million different ways. You know, it's not just in sex. It's like, or pleasure, you know, it's that like, you know, learning where I feel feelings in my body, learning what my body is like telling me, and then learning how to feel safety in my body, which is so complicated, especially when you add chronic illness into the picture. So there was a lot of work that I had to do just with myself to build my tolerance for embodiment. And you know, it also involved finding the people that I could be really honest and vulnerable with, you know, and one of the examples that I share in the book is, you know, this person that who I had known, we had sort of known each other through similar circles for many years. And then one summer I was like back visiting home where they lived, and we decided to go on a date and we had sex after. And I was just so not connected at any point, but I really wanted to continue to see this person. And so I was like, okay, you know what? I have enough of an understanding of myself now to know what triggers me. And, you know, for me, one of those pieces was like moving very quickly, you know, from one sexual act to another, and next thing you know, we're having sex. And, you know, and I had to be like, actually what I need is to slow things down. And so I asked them like, hey, could we actually have a conversation about this? Could I share with you what some of my triggers are and how to work with them? And they were just like, yes, let's do that. And they met me with such openness, no judgment. They were, you know, they felt honored, quite honestly, that I had like brought this to them. And in just the act of having this conversation with them when we had sex the next time, I was present. I felt pleasure. It was amazing. And so it is, you know, I think all healing work is a combination of the work we're doing on ourselves, whether that's through therapy or personal reflection or whatever that path looks like. And then we have to practice that with other humans. And we have to pick the humans that are hopefully going to want to show up and do that work with us.
And I think being able to work through vulnerability and being vulnerable, it's such a beautiful example of seeing a connection, being able to see a connection and verbalizing and talking to them about it and how wonderful that they were able to show up. There's just so many great things that you talk about in your book that encourage people to definitely check it out. But for my last question, I want to hear your thought. I know you talk about pleasure can be an act of healing, political act of healing. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. So, you know, for me, healing is inherently political. We live in a world where, you know, there's just so much trauma happening around us and to us all the time. And if we are humans who are marginalized in some way, shape, or form, whether as women, as femmes, you know, as queer people, as trans people, as people of color, you know, as people who are disabled, the systems in the world that we live in are set up to actually cause us pain and to make accessing pleasure so much more difficult. Because when we experience pleasure, like that fuels us, right? Like that heals us. And so it's kind of actually seen as like something that's like dangerous and very radical. And so for me, you know, and then I think also within, you know, activist circles, we also kind of like really minimize how important pleasure is. You know, it's like you got to do the most radical thing, put in all the hard work, you know, and pleasure is seen as somehow frivolous, not as important to like, you know, but it's like when we are showing up and owning our pleasure, owning our desires, not only is that like healing for us, but it's also healing for other people because they get to witness us in our pleasure and it gives them permission to do the same. And so the more and more that we orient towards pleasure, not in a way where we're, you know, disavowing pain, where we're silver lining it, where we are ignoring the pain and suffering of the world, but actually in this way where we can hold both and, that is going to give us the power and the fuel that we need to create the world that we dream of, a world where everyone has access to pleasure as they want it, with whomever they want it, whenever they want it. So that's what I mean.
What a beautiful invitation. And for our listeners that they are curious to learn more about you and your book, what are some of the places that they can find you?
Yeah. So I have a website, which is just margofeldman.com. Easy for you. So you can learn more there about my writing, including my book, as well as I teach a lot of webinars and workshops, you know, around interpersonal skills and how we do those things when we live with trauma. So you can find more of the things I do in the world there. I am also on Substack. I write a weekly newsletter called Carescapes, filled with personal essays. And right now I've just started sharing about my journey into non-monogamy and what that's looked like and how healing that has been, as well as challenging. So you can find me there by just looking up Carescapes. And I also technically still exist on Instagram, even though I'm not posting there regularly anymore. But if you want some like trauma, relationship, healing, education in fun, bite-sized forms such as memes, you can find my memes there and a bunch of other ways to connect with me.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Margo, for coming in the show and sharing your story with us, and hopefully we have you in future episodes.
Thanks so much for having me, Naz.
Bye there.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope you're easing into this holiday season with a little bit more softness, a little more pleasure, and a lot more compassion for yourself. And if you're feeling inspired to bring some excitement or intentionality into your intimate life, this is actually the perfect time to create a sex bucket list. Yes, truly. Whether you want to deepen connection with a partner or simply reconnect with yourself, having playful, thoughtful lists can open up whole new pathways to pleasure. We've put together a free sex bucket list to help you get started. It's full of ideas, prompts, and inspiration you can explore together or completely on your own. You can grab it using the link in the show notes. And when you've made your list, I'd love to hear what you came up with. Send us a DM at Sexology Podcast in Instagram. Wishing you a beautiful holiday season filled with rest, connection, and moments that feel really, truly good. I'll see you in the next episode of the Sexology Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Sexology Podcast. For more great content, visit www.sexologypodcast.com. Please be advised that information presented on this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health provider.